Hello, I'm Tony Collins, and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. This week, I've got a special guest who is my good friend, Gavin Willacy. Gavin and I met many years ago when he was writing a book about the history of Scottish Rugby League, Rugby League Bravehearts. But since then, he's become the guru of all things American Rugby League, thanks to his fantastic book, No Helmets Required, which if you haven't read, make sure you go and read it as soon as possible. So, Gavin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me on.
The first question I wanted to ask was basically, can you just outline, for those listeners who haven't read the book, can you just tell me something about the genesis of No Helmets Required and the broad outlines of the fantastic story that you tell there?
The broad outline, the basic story is about a team called the American All-Stars who went on tour to Australia, New Zealand and France in 1953 to play rugby league against the best teams in the world, pretty much. However, that's just the start of it. None of them had ever played rugby league before. None of them had ever seen a game of rugby league. In fact, none of them had ever heard of it. Some of them had played rugby union. Most of them had played American football. They were called the All-Stars because most of them had some claim to fame in the sporting world, that they were a star at something or other. But they were put together by a guy called Mike Dimitro, who was an American football player in college and very successfully so at UCLA in Los Angeles. Then became a teacher, but had a real lust to get back in the limelight. And he saw a game at the Sydney Cricket Ground during the war, Second World War. And when he was desperately trying to put together some sort of sporting adventure in the early 50s, he harked back to what he'd seen and enjoyed and thought, right, a rugby league tour of Australia. Let's see if I can get that off the ground. And somehow he managed to convince not only 20 young American sportsmen to go with him, but also hoodwinked the Australian Rugby League Board of Control into believing he had a team of rugby league players ready to come over and play against Queensland, Brisbane, Sydney, New South Wales, and all the teams we know now all the way up and down the East Coast. And miraculously, they actually won some games.
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing. I mean, clearly these are exhibition matches, so the Australian teams didn't play at maximum velocity, but they were competitive. And they weren't, once they got into the game, as you make clear in the book, they weren't mugs at it either, were they? They had to be taken seriously.
They weren't mugs at all. And it was quite nuanced, really, what we think happened. Basically, we've only got footage from one game, but from the newspaper reports and what the players have told me, because I was lucky enough to interview about 12 of the players, most of the games were treated like exhibition matches, but when they went up into the country and out into the bush, the local reputations were on the line, and you know, local players were, this was a big game for them. They were playing in front of, maybe 5,000 on a ground in Rockhampton or somewhere like that, and they weren't going to get beaten by the Americans. So I think the games up in the country were possibly more competitive than the ones in Brisbane and Sydney, which were more like exhibitions when the star players were up against these blokes who'd never played the game in their lives before. But because they had players who were from UCLA, USC, Stanford, some of the top American football colleges in the country, and of course this was before the NFL really took off, the equivalent now would be saying some of these players would have gone into the NFL. So they were extremely quick, strong. They could throw, they could catch, and they could tackle. They just had to learn how to tackle in a rugby league way. So with the ball, they were dangerous and they scored a heap of points. But defensively, they were all over the shop, as you'd expect, and conceded even more.
I think one of the things that's interesting about this is that in the last podcast on 1906, where I talk about how Albert Baskerville got in contact with Walter Camp, the father of American football, and Stanford University, about converting to rugby. And he said that he thought, because of the training and fitness of American athletes, they would soon become very proficient at rugby. Now, this at the time was rugby union. It was just before Baskerville organised the team. But it seems that, in fact, Dimitro proved that was correct, that they'd, because of their training that they had, the fact that you know, as I'm sure most people listening to this would agree, that rugby league and American football have a lot of parallels in the way that the game's played. They managed to make the transition pretty well.
Absolutely. But I think also these players were mainly 21, 22, 23 years old. And some of them were just finishing off at university. Some of them were a year out of it. But most of them were quite fresh from it. So they've pretty much were full-time professionals just without being paid. So their fitness levels were probably really high compared to the guys they were playing against, who probably jogged around the paddock twice a week, throwing the ball around before playing. You know, I think they were probably fitter and stronger, and they were certainly bigger than their opponents. The only problem being that they didn't really know what they were doing, and they didn't have enough players. So they'd taken fewer than they intended, or Demetrio had taken fewer than he'd said he would. And when the injuries struck, the team was completely depleted. And their problem was, as they always did in the old days, they played as many games as possible to make as much money as possible. So they were playing at least twice a week, sometimes three times a week, which was unfeasible to survive that sort of physical test.
Did Demetrio have any long-term plans, or did he just want to have a barnstorming team that, as you said, went on tour to make money? Reading the book, I can't remember anything in it that sort of gave some sense that Demetrio was going to go back and form a league, or he had any kind of long-term goals about how to develop the league in America.
He mentioned it, but like everything with Demetrio, it was off the cuff. It was just prompted by something someone would say. You know, he liked to tell people things they wanted to hear. So he did at one point say, oh, yeah, we're going to have a league when we get back. But I've not seen any evidence to suggest that he thought that through. But within a few months of the tours being over, there was talk of leagues being launched there. But different people got involved, and triggering the sort of squabbling and, in the end, failure to actually deliver anything that we're seeing again now. It's a bit like it was like the Brexit of 1950s rugby league, you know, everybody wanting something slightly different, and in the end nothing happening.
It's a classic rugby league never misses an opportunity and miss an opportunity moment.
Yes.
In that, wasn't there that there was not only Demetrio was trying to get the game going, but also Ward B. Nash in California was trying to get the, and he had a different, because he was a journalist, he had a different background, but he was very he was very friendly with Bill Fallowfield. And it was Nash's initiative that brought the Australian New Zealand sides to California in 1954.
Yes, and Fallowfield had been monitoring everything that was happening all the way along, and he came over to watch the Australian New Zealand games in 54. They were on their way back from the World Cup, and they played in Long Beach and at the Coliseum. And Fallowfield was very damning of what had happened in the presentation, but still said that, you know, there's potential for this sport here. But it was all about getting the right people involved. Now, you know, it's no surprise that some of the folk that put their hands up and said, oh, I'm interested in rugby league in America, let's get it started, might not necessarily have been the most qualified or experienced or financed people to actually do that. But instead of harnessing all their energy and enthusiasm and putting them in touch with the right people to make it happen, there was some real negativity which cut people out of the loop, and in the end it all fell apart. But I think it was the lack of overall vision. I mean, it's just like now really with America or North America, there was no vision. There wasn't enough alliance between the RFL and the Australian and New Zealand board to say, what do we want to do with America? There's potential here. How should we do this? What approach should we take? What's our strategy? It was just a few unconnected ventures that had partial success, but not enough success for anyone to think, right, that's going to work. Let's do that again.
But I'm presumably the kind of worst example of that was the refusal to allow the Americans to play in the 1954 World Cup.
That was absolute madness when you look back at it, when you say about missing opportunities. The French invited them, as you know, and I think the French invited Yugoslavia and Italy as well. But I believe it was Bill Fallowfield. It may have been the whole of the RFL board, I'm not sure. But they basically put the kibosh on that and said, no, they can't be in it. They don't have a proper team or competition. And that was extremely short-sighted. I mean, it was true. but it was short-sighted, because imagine what an impact that could have made if they'd have gone to a World Cup in France and held their own, and they've got some better players than they had the first time round that they went, and who knows what might have happened afterwards.
Well, I think that's the thing, because it's American sports in the 1950s was, they were just discovering television, and television was just discovering how important sport was to drive television sales and television viewers. It was professional American football that capitalized on that, and especially got the 1958 famous Giants versus Colts NFL championship match that kind of was the defining moment in professional football's attitude to relationship to TV.
And you absolutely. Just wonder in that game, yeah, one of the all-stars was on the sidelines. Gary Kerkorian, the halfback, was in the Baltimore Colts squad for that game as the fourth choice quarterback. He'd left the tour of Australia at the end of the Australian leg of the tour of the all-stars, because he'd got a contract with the Colts and played in the NFL for about 3 years, and then he played for the Steelers and was cut, and that is why he went on the tour with the All-Stars, because he'd been cut by the Steelers and was free to go, but then got an offer from the Colts. But that you're absolutely spot on about that period in the 50s. I mentioned in the book when the LA Rams and San Francisco 49ers are being tapped up to form rugby league teams, and they go beyond one meeting. You know, they are actually reasonably interested in this prospect, and BC Lions up in Vancouver as well, and Hamilton Tiger Cats and the two CFL teams. They were all approached, and there was movement. And there were about a year and a half of meetings about this. But during that period, for example, the 49ers against the Rams, the California Derby, as you might call it, the attendance from that doubled from about, I think it was 40,000 to 80,000 over three seasons. As the NFL just took off with television. The TV was the trigger. And imagine a USA team playing in a World Cup in France, shown live on TV in the States. So, you know, who knows what impact that would have had.
Yeah, and obviously then there was a 57 World Cup in Australia and 60 in Britain. So there was the potential to actually capitalise on what was going on in American sport and television and the way things were changing was pretty significant at the time. And I think to some extent, we're at a similar kind of turning point in the way that sport is developing at the moment, with the growth of the internet, digital TV, ease of international travel. There's a sense that there's something to be made of here. And I think one of the non-soccer sports is going to grab hold of this opportunity in a way that wasn't done in the 1950s. The other thing I was going to ask you about, which I think is a fantastic thing about the book, is the way that you managed to get in touch with so many of the players decades after they played in this and record their memories. And most of them still have fond memories of their experiences.
Absolutely, yeah. Their eyes would light up when you mentioned anything about it. And they reveled in telling me the stories. Sometimes I met them when they were two or three together, and they sort of bounced stories off each other, and it helped jog their memories. But my first research was about 15, 16, 17 years ago now. So some of those players sadly have passed away. I have recently tried to contact them all to see who's still alive and kicking. And I've got at least six of them have replied, and I know they're still with us and with it. And I'm still hoping that at some stage very soon I might get to do a documentary about the story. That's my ambition, to go out and film these guys whilst they can still tell us about what really happened.
Because, I mean, as you've said many times before, it's just a great story. You don't have to be a rugby league lover or to know anything about the sport to appreciate it's a great adventure story.
Yeah, it's completely mad. And we haven't mentioned anything that went on off the field, you don't have to buy the book to find out. But, you know, they were as colourful as anything. Looking back on it, it probably didn't help what went on off the field, especially things like not paying your bills and some general dubious accounting, that sort of stuff. I don't think that helped because basically the Australian didn't want to deal with Mike Dimitro again, and he was the driving force of the whole project. So they burnt the bridges somewhat.
Are there any lessons for today? Obviously, the RFL has announced that it's going to put the question of the inclusion of New York franchise to the clubs. The Wolfpack have been very successful in North America. It appears that there may be an Ottawa team joining as well. Is there anything that we can learn from the All-Stars in terms of what the game is trying to do, or elements the game are trying to do in North America today?
Well, absolutely. Well, I think it sort of brings two of the things that you've just that you mentioned earlier together. One is that there's still no vision. We're talking about a world, an international decision here, you know, bringing American and Canadian teams into our league. Now, these conversations may have taken place, but no one's been told that. Have the RFL and Super League and the NRL sat down and discussed this and said, right, you know, have the Australians said, right, you go for America, you develop America? Because I don't think they have. There was a great podcast on the Rugby League in America podcast, Nate Gladimon, which you were on recently, but with Shane Richardson, the South Sydney Rabbitohs general manager, a few months ago, talking about what they were trying to do in the States and their plans for Los Angeles. And they seem really serious and, you know, doing due diligence on how the NRL is going to break America. And I have no idea whether the RFL and Super League are fully aware of all that, if they're on board with it, if it's a partnership, if it's all part of a strategy, or if everyone's doing their own thing. Because if they're all doing their own thing, it's short-sighted and it's narrow-minded and it's not going to help succeed. And the other thing Well, I was just going to say that it also comes back to what you said about internationalism and who's going to break out. Rugby league has a history not only of missing opportunities, but also of being extremely innovative and making things happen. So on a more positive note, you know, maybe I'm not suggesting rugby league can become a huge sport, but if we are the first to get teams from America and Canada into elite competition, and we might see an international league develop and something that's watched all over the world, but they're going to have to be brave about it and not tiptoe and go in half-hearted.
Yeah, I think you're right, because there's this half-hearted idea, which I think is really how you could sum up the idea that the other clubs in the RFL should decide whether New York or Ottawa come in. It should be a strategic decision. It's
absolutely
a governing body decision. It's not. It shouldn't be done on the basis of what the requirements of individual clubs are.
Yeah, I mean, no disrespect to Barrow or Batley or Dewsbury or London Scholars, for example, or any of those teams. But why are they going to decide whether Super League ends up with New York, Ottawa, and whoever else in it in 5 years' time? Surely Super League has to be saying, right, we want a 16-team international competition playing across the exact period as the NRL is, and we want it in 5 years' time, and this is what we want to happen in the meantime. Putting it to the individual club, you know, the clubs to decide based on their own interests seems incredibly naive to me.
Yeah, it's kind of the way the game in Britain always works, because that's how it's always been done in the past. But we're in a position now that things are changing in all sports. And there's an opportunity that we have. And I think what you just said earlier on, that rugby league has a lot of advantages, and it actually has been very strong in taking initiatives and being innovative. The thing that it's got, and I think this is the thing that has made it attractive to people like David Argyle, is that it's a mass spectator sport, but it's one that can change and innovate very quickly, unlike soccer, which is just, it just is soccer. There's nothing you can do about it. Rugby union is still very, despite the fact it's professional, it's still very hidebound and wedded to many of its traditions, which is one of the problems they've got in America. So rugby league has a lot of advantages that I'm not quite sure that it's aware of. It's not quite sure of how to maximise those advantages. So, yeah, hopefully that people will read No Helmets Required and draw some appropriate conclusions from that experience.
Absolutely. I look at what rugby union's done with it. We think we're amazing that we've got Toronto Wolfpack playing Halifax, etc. And it does, you know, people say, really? You know, how did that happen? You explain. And it, as exactly as you said, it shows that the sport is flexible and can react quickly and make decisions. But the fact that it's one team playing across the Atlantic, and yet in rugby union, in the Pro 14, they've got South African teams. You know, there's the team from Singapore playing in the Super 15 or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
So we're not alone in this. You know, the playing across around the world is normal for every other sport now. So we have to stop patting ourselves on the back that we're doing what everyone else is already doing and look at what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong. I see the South African teams in that Pro 14 are playing in front of three men and a dog. How can that carry on? So you've got to go big with it. You know, we can't go half-hearted with this. It needs to be all in and ambitious or not at all, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. On that positive note, I'm going to leave it there because we've run out of time. So I'd like to say thanks to my guest, Gavin Willacy, and remind you that the book is called No Helmets Required. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Rugby Reloaded Plus. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my name is @ColinStoney. If you want to follow Gavin, if you don't already, his name is @NoHelmetsRequired. And if you want to dig a bit deeper into the history of rugby and the other football codes, take a look at the Rugby Reloaded website at www.rugbyreloaded.com. Until next week, thanks for listening.